Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, another episode here in May of 2019 on the 16th of May, the weekly show, or it's not a show, we don't have any pictures here, the podcast of Photo Geekery. We dive into the details that the industry throws at us on a weekly basis. I'm your host, Don Kamarechka, always joined by a co-host, and this week, none other than my favorite Canadian currently living in Germany, and a guy fresh off of the baseball field, Alan Attridge. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. It is a show, by the way. It's not just a podcast, it's a show. You don't have people look at pictures. You're fine. It's a show.
Okay. Well, I mean, okay, theater of the mind then, right? You know, like it's a radio broadcast.
That's the best
kind.
People,
you know. Yeah, there you go. So what's new and exciting with you?
I did just get off the baseball field. We had an exhibition game tonight. We played – this can't be interesting for anybody, but we play exhibition games against a local high school, which is kind of funny because I'm really old. I'm the oldest guy on the team. The rest of the kids are much younger. They're all 19, 20, and I'm the old guy. But so we play exhibition games.
Do you come in and do like professional portraits of these guys in their baseball attire and things like that as well? Or are you just strictly like a coach/player?
For our own team? Yeah, we do each home game we have our own sort of game day magazine that we do called Spieltag, which means game day in German. And each week I come up with a new sort of theme, like a new and shoot something. And last week we did a takeoff. Are you asking because you saw this one?
No, I didn't.
Oh,
I'm just curious.
This was a little controversial, actually. So we did a takeoff on the movie Bull Durham, which is a baseball movie, which if you haven't seen, I highly recommend, from 1987. Kevin Costner, Tim Robbins, Susan Sarandon. Great. Probably the best baseball movie ever made. And there's a scene in it where Tim Robbins...
I don't know. Does it beat The Sandlot?
It does. It does, in general.
Okay, I don't
know.
Yeah,
it could be a generational thing, but in the movie, Tim Robbins is a young pitcher. He has a nightmare that he is pitching naked, and that is portrayed in the movie. And so I basically reshot that for the cover using one of the guys on our team. And so it sort of made it on Instagram, but there's a little bit of a shadow ban because of the content.
Right. So, and so that might be why I did not see it.
Could be. Yeah,
but
so.
The response from the team and potentially this man's family in general,
very very positive. It was you can check out on my Instagram on we can look for us, the Tubingen Hawks is the name of our team.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes for sure.
Have a look. And I shot a slightly, it's not safe for work, but still safer for work version, and then the one that made the cover. And so I do this every week, and yeah, the guys have a good time with it. But I'm there to play too. I'm not just the photographer.
Right. And you know, I've never been I played baseball in elementary school, but not much for the sport after that. When it became overly competitive and everybody was really cutthroat in competitive sports at that age, it's just like, you know what, I'm gonna go bugger off and do my own things and play video games or whatever else I did at the time.
And that's what we're here to talk about, photo stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, later on, of course, I became interested in photography, which is now my full-time gig. And this past week, I had a bunch of photography workshops. Actually, I was in London, Ontario, doing some water droplet refraction workshops, and here in my own studio, actually on Mother's Day, I had a workshop. And shout out to Jeff and Matthew who were in that workshop, and I know they listen avidly to the podcast. Thanks for being here. That was great. And Juan, who was here just after that this past week as well, thanks for listening. You guys, you make this podcast worth doing, especially when I get positive commentary on that. But you give positive commentary because we talk about interesting things. So let's get into the interesting things. Topic number one today, and this kind of stuck in my craw a little bit because I found out about it in an email from Adobe, and then of course it's been broadcast on the news. This article's from DP Review. Adobe informs users that using old versions of their CC, their Creative Cloud apps, could lead to lawsuits from third parties. And the email from Adobe stipulated exactly that. They warned, you know, don't use any of our older software because you could be subject to copyright infringement from third parties. And further, like reading around on the internet, there's basically some claims from Adobe, some statements saying basically that they can't talk about this because of ongoing litigation. They can't give us the details, but the details are there. You don't have to dig very
hard.
Don
will give you the details.
I will give you the details. And I mean, they're presented in this article to some degree. Do you know what connection Dolby has with Adobe, Alan?
And I'm assuming you mean Thomas Dolby, She Blinded Me with Science, that song?
Sure, why not? Let's just go there.
Okay, then no connection whatsoever. No, I don't know. I don't know. I would assume that Dolby, now my, for lack of a better word, dealings or any connection I would have with Dolby would be their sound engineering built within Final Cut Pro. And not necessarily Final Cut Pro, but in the program used to make DVDs, DVD Studio Pro, which has long been shuttered, and you would basically encode using some sort of Dolby software for decoding later on DVD players. So,
right. Dolby, well, we might associate them with being a sound company. They've got a huge patent portfolio, and they've got a lot of intellectual property. And so it's not uncommon for these large tech companies to have to license a patent from each other in order to produce a product. Mm-hmm. And it's also not uncommon for these large technology companies to sue each other. I mean, you could name pretty much any big tech company, and you can do a quick Google search and see where they've sued somebody and where they've been sued. I mean, this is so common in the industry. As best as we can tell from this, is Dolby has licensed some of its intellectual property to Adobe, and Adobe wasn't paying its fair share, probably because somewhere in the contract it said and I'm just making this up. This is like pure assumptions on my part, that you would have to pay per user per piece of software. That kind of language is, you know, fairly commonplace in order to license the work. But then per piece of software could be every single version of Photoshop that a user has installed. You've got 10 different versions of Photoshop installed.
Right.
Well, then you have to, as an Adobe, has to pay Dolby for that user's 10 different products. This is my assumption of what kind of arguments might come up, because then Adobe goes back and forth saying, no, they're a user of Photoshop, so what if they have different versions? And Adobe says, look at the contract, you owe us more money. So suffice to say, we have Photoshop CC version 18.6 or 18.1.6. That is the 2017 release of Photoshop that is still usable. Plus everything the 2018 and 2019 releases, they're completely useful. But if you have an earlier version of Photoshop installed, the way things are shaking out right now, Dolby could come to you and say, you are infringing on our rights because the software that you're using isn't properly licensed, and start suing users. Now, would that happen? Probably not. They'd lose quite fiercely in the court of public opinion, even if they could win in the court of law. But it kind of leaves me annoyed, because Adobe has put, you know, they are still an industry standard, and that's changing, but they have put out record earnings reports.
Right.
They are making more money, boatloads of cash, than they have ever made before, and they're jerking around with these licenses. So what do you make of all this?
At first glance, I didn't care, and then I read deeper and thought, well, wow, you're right. Adobe is making a bunch of money, and maybe they should make money. I happen to like their products, but that's an aside. I happen to think that I like Photoshop. I like Audition. I like all the whole suite, but it reminded me of a story from a long time ago. Now, I like movies. I went to film school. I love movies. One of my favorite movies ever made was a movie called Animal House. 1978.
You've mentioned that on this podcast before.
Have I really? Wow. Okay.
Regale us with this story.
New area too. Okay. So I remember a long, long time ago, I was like, you know what? I have to own. This is when VHS was still in existence. I have to own Animal House. So I went and bought it, got home, watched the movie, and it was terrible. It was just awful. And I thought, oh no, what is it? All the background music was gone. All the classic stuff, all the Sam Cooke, et cetera, all these original music that really made the movie was just gone. And it was synthesized, like synthesizers that I could have done. And I have no musical talent at all. And it was just awful.
So they did not have the license beyond the theatrical release.
Because it didn't exist.
That music.
Because in 1978, nobody thought, hey, we're going to do home video one day. Let's secure that release. And so they went back and said, hey, we want this. Well, they said, well, Animal House is a phenomenal success. So we're going to basically, you know, charge 10 times what we would have charged. And they didn't have the money. Now, that's one small thing. This happened a lot with a lot of movies and home movies and then television, etc. There's a TV show that maybe you know, maybe you don't, called The Wonder Years.
I cannot recall.
Oh, my. Okay, that was a test.
You are dating yourself here.
Yep. It was a movie, a TV show came out in the late 80s, set in the late 60s, right? And it's actually an amazing show. I recommend you check it out. And so you can imagine it was set from like in 1967 on up. So all this amazing music, Buffalo Springfield, it's set, all the classics, and they show it on television and they play all the music and the series is amazing. You go to get it on video. You can't. They even just said, look, we're not doing it because we can't get the rights.
Right.
Okay. So this happened. So that's what this seemed to me that Adobe was doing. Now, maybe they're not. Maybe they're just cheaping out. Maybe they're applying pressure on Dolby in the court of public opinion to say, no, we'll keep all the money.
Yeah. Well, if I look back to Photoshop CC, the very first one in the Creative Cloud suite, they had a feature, I think it was under the filter menu, called oil painting. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of interesting, a little broken, but it worked interesting to get a painting-like effect to a photograph. I actually used it for some of my clients that hired me for illustration work to smooth out really pixelated edges by turning the texture and the oil painting features down, but just using it as a function to smooth things out. Enter the next version of Photoshop CC. It's not there anymore. Just completely gone. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Maybe it was a licensing issue. Adobe is famous or infamous for not removing features. I mean, Photoshop has so much baggage in it that it's been carried forward, because if anything disappears, people go up in arms because, you know, that 1% of the users that used a particular function now no longer have it and they riot in the streets. So I'm curious what exactly Adobe had licensed from Dolby to, and it's not just in Photoshop. It was in Photoshop, InDesign, Premiere, Media Encoder, After Effects, Animate, Audition, Lightroom Classic, Bridge, Prelude, SpeedGrade, and which has now been discontinued, maybe because they just couldn't work around the issue and then patch it, and then Captivate, which a lot of the software I've never used. You should be aware, if you're using any of this software, that you have to use the latest versions. I cannot anymore go back to that Photoshop CC, which I have installed, because I still would find obscure uses for that oil painting filter. Can no longer use it without potentially getting sued from Dolby. So thank you, Adobe.
I would imagine that you're not going to get sued.
Yeah, but I don't want to risk it. It's so unlikely, but you know, it's also unlikely that you'd get sued from pirating movies and music and everything. And I don't do any of that either. I respect intellectual property.
Yes, that's a separate thing.
But this is still an intellectual property issue. It's just one that's buried and a little bit more convoluted.
It sounds like two separate people are fighting and basically holding the users hostage. That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, interesting to see how this will shake out. Again, it's not uncommon for big tech companies to be suing each other, but it is uncommon for it to have a direct consumer-facing impact that just kind of shows up out of the blue. So anybody using Adobe software, there's your PSA. And with the oodles of money that Adobe is making, they've actually added a new feature to Camera Raw and Lightroom. Alan, I don't know, you photograph people more than I do. So from Petapixel, there's this add-on little article to that first story about Adobe adding a texture control slider to Lightroom and Camera Raw. Now, they had a clarity slider and a dehaze slider, and this kind of fits within that same area of the basic panel when you're going through this. Have you tried this out at all?
Now, this is a couple days old, I think, only.
Yeah, this is brand new.
So I did upgrade today, as a matter of fact. I've been busy, and I did mess around with it in the just ever so slightly. And it looks pretty cool. It kind of looks... It's funny because the name sounds great because I like texture in my photos, but... It felt to me in the few minutes I had with it that it seems like a clarity light slider.
Kinda, yeah. It doesn't clarity. I've always found to be too grungy. Like it really sucks down shadows and makes things look somewhat lifeless when you really crank it up. Because when you bring those shadows down, it'll also tend to desaturate some of those areas as a result of whatever algorithms it uses. And I was never a huge fan of it for general use.
No, I think the highest I've ever gone is three or four on the clarity in either direction. I like it in theory, but then in practice it goes south very quickly.
And when you move it to the negative side, it just looks like it looks false. It looks so fake.
Well, that's what we're expecting.
I'd rather smear Vaseline on my lens than move the clarity slider to the negative, right?
It you're not wrong. But that's a hot button issue because I mean, I'm not a big fan of softening images in post. I don't like smoothing. I don't like filters. I don't like when people do it to pictures I've given them either, which I've seen people post them on Instagram and they've smoothed them. And I said, well, okay, I'm not going to fight you on it, but what I shot was your best you. Now, what you're looking at is not you. That is no longer you. You never appear that way in real life. Please, for your own sake, don't do it. Don't smooth this out. And so I don't do it. I believe firmly in lighting somebody as flatteringly as possible. And that's it. And if you have, for example, I have this own sort of, it's my own personal.
I'm sure you would remove a pimple or something that is a temporary blemish on somebody's
temporary.
Face,
that's
correct?
my policy is if it's temporary, yes. If it's a scar, no, that's you, man. I like you. You should like you. And I remember I had a mother say that to me one time. I took pictures of their kid, a friend of mine, a long time ago, and I said, "Well, his ears look kind of pointy. Can you straighten them out?" And I said,
maybe you can do that with
time.
Some
will
extracurricular
do that.
Activities.
Yeah,
I mean, try to reshape those ears yourself and bring them back to me.
Yeah, I'm not going to. I'm not going to do that. So I said, no. But yes, you're right. Pimples, anything that is a temporary thing, absolutely, that can go. But
when I'm dealing with enhancing images, typically, like if I'm focus stacking or if I'm just trying to create the best initial results, I'll go through some level of sharpening or detail enhancement within a photograph. I mean, I'm not shooting pictures of people. I've like we mentioned the clarity slider. Kind of is heavy-handed. So is the dehaze because it'll often sway colors into a way that I'm not a huge fan of. Mm-hmm. So texture, when I was moving this around, it has an appreciable impact. You know that could be useful, but it doesn't supersede stuff that I've used in the past. Prior to on One Photo Raw, I would use what was it? Nik Software had Silver Effects Pro. Mm-hmm. And they had some structure sliders in there. And I would muck with those until I get something that looks really good as a black and white image. But then I would overlay that on the colored image and change its its blending mode to luminosity, so that it would just give me the enhancement of the texture that I would dial in usually with the layer mask where I wanted it to be. Right. Now the structure sliders in On One are still sort of paramount to this detail enhancing. And I did a comparison between the new texture control from Adobe versus the structure sliders in On One, and On One still wins for me. But if people don't want to use multiple pieces of software and you're stuck in the Adobe ecosystem right now, then there's another tool for you to use. That's about all we can say on that one. There you go. Check it out. Come to your own conclusions. The article on Petapixel that we're linking to has some before and after examples, as well as some comparisons to just harsh sharpening, so that you can see the difference. And yeah, it's a step forward, at least. All of that money that Adobe is gathering being put back in some small ways to us as the subscribers.
Is Adobe, you still use Adobe?
I use it when I have to, which is becoming less and less. I mean, I'm using On One Photo Raw as a digital asset manager. They can only focus stack up to 14 frames, and I'm usually doing more than that for some of my work, so Photoshop becomes a necessity. But if I didn't have to have the Adobe suite, I would not be paying them some exorbitant amount of money every month. Which, just for my, if there's any tax, like accountants or tax lawyers out there listening, and photography is your hobby, this has always bothered me. Adobe charges me in US dollars. Mm-hmm. So my statement always comes in USD, mm-hmm. yet they're charging me harmonized sales tax in Ontario. I didn't think you could do that, to charge me in a foreign currency and local tax at the same time.
Right.
That's bothered me forever.
A lot of it's bothered me, but okay. You want to get into the tax? We just had tax day a couple weeks ago. The fact that you have to collect HST for the government as it is, you're a tax collector now.
Oh yeah. Well, anybody that has a business that takes in more than $30,000 a year in revenue has to charge tax. And I just had to pay my HST back to the government yesterday, is when, because my corporate year end is not in sync with everybody else. Mm-hmm. And I grumbled a lot about that because, you know, it comes in small amounts, and then you realize, oh, wow, you've got to pay back thousands of dollars.
Yeah. I just did that myself, as a matter of fact, and thought, yeah, wow. How about this? Government, who they're not listening, charge 7%, make us pay 6%. We'll keep that 1% just for doing the work for you. Okay, moving on.
Yeah. All right, moving on.
All right.
Let's go to our next story. This one, I'm of two minds on this, because technology is constantly moving forward, and we should expect better sensors for imaging in every device that we have, our cameras, our smartphones, heck, even our doorbells, because I got one of those new Nest Hellos the other day. But from DP Review, it is reporting that Samsung has launched a 64 megapixel image sensor for smartphones. All the way back to one of the earlier Nokia, it's like a PureView or something, they had a 40 megapixel sensor in that. And that's years ago now. And it raised an eyebrow for me, because there's no possible way that a 40 megapixel sensor that can fit inside of a smartphone could give you 40 megapixels of resolution.
It does say 40 megapixels on it, though.
It does say 40 megapixels on it, and technically, you would have 40 million or thereabouts photo sites on the sensor to collect light. And so Samsung is now pushing that to 64, as well as launching a new revamped 48 megapixel variant, of which they had one previously as well. So there's a few things wrong with this. What do you think I'm going to mention first, Alan?
The fact that 63 megapixel images are for suckers.
Well, there's that. It's diffraction, really, is the primary issue for me. Where when you have pixels this small, and yes, it's the same 0.8 micrometer pixels as their current 48 megapixel sensor, because it's a physically bigger sensor, but it still doesn't negate the problem that light is going to start bending off course, even at fairly wide apertures, when your pixels are so small, and will start coloring outside the lines. Just look up diffraction limiting, and you'll find all sorts of charts and calculators and examples as to why even a 50 megapixel digital SLR, full frame camera, like the Canon 5DSR, will start to hit a limit of diffraction when you're shooting, you know, F16 and F22, starting to cut that resolution down a little bit. When you cram that same resolution into a sensor that is a fraction of the size, diffraction will hit and limit the resolution even at your maximum aperture. So you're not going to ever get that resolution.
Right.
So why are you buying or why are they even manufacturing sensors that have that many pixels in them?
I would like them to stop it. Just honestly stop. If we, I mean, we went through this, when did the megapixel battle end? I mean, effectively, there's still the last bastion, the last outpost still happening. But in the DSLR world, there was a long stretch when it went from 4 to 6 to, oh my God, we got 10.
Oh, and then when we went from 12 to 21 between the 5D and the 5D Mark II, that was, right, I think, the last hurrah for the megapixel race. And then once we were there, you can get more, but it's a bigger number at that point.
Right. So I assume that they're just trying to continue that to smartphone owners. Is that a selling point? I don't know how many megapixels my iPhone has.
I mean, the typical is 12 to 16 on a lot of smartphones these days. But what they'll do is they'll take this 64 megapixel image and distill it down to only 16 megapixels.
Right.
Whatever you want to call that technology, pixel binning or pixel merging, which would in theory create a smoother transition, possibly removing moiré from the image or better noise performance as a result of that. But then I go back to the original question: why don't you just make a really good 16 megapixel image, mm-hmm, instead of like overshooting that target by a large margin, shrinking it back down to say that this is better results?
I blame Dolby on this one as well. This is why I want them to stop. It's enough already. We're way past that. Make a really good, make an X-ray feature like the back of comic books from the 70s and 80s when you had those X-ray glasses, you could see through your hand. Like, that's, do that.
Yeah,
that'll impress me.
I think you might give people cancer with one of those.
No. Just the non-cancer ones.
Oh, those ones. Okay.
I feel like we could do that.
I don't know if we're there yet, but I think that would be a leap that I would buy into if it was a product that I was able to purchase.
But the bottom line is okay, great. You got 64 megapixels. You got 65 megapixels. And what next? Obviously 66 if we're going in order, but how's the glass? And so I find like my favorite images I still shoot are my 5D Classic with a not even a great but a decent lens. So it's, to me, it's all about the glass. If you're cranking up the 64 megapixels, who cares if you've got just a little piece of plastic in front?
Well, it's funny because Samsung left the camera market a while ago. Their mirrorless cameras were great, and a lot of people really enjoyed what they were creating with those. And then they just completely abruptly shuttered the entire lineup because it wasn't necessarily as profitable for them as it could have been. Mm-hmm. But you look at what they're doing. I mean, they're in the camera industry. They're making sensors. They're making I'm assuming the memory chips that go into at least some cameras on the market, because they're big into the random access memory market and all of that. So if you've got a big buffer on your camera, there's got to be chips backing that up, and Samsung is getting a piece of the pie in that sense. Maybe it was a smart move for them to start just making the components and not the end products, because we go get into the next story, where it's kind of a twofold one. The first story, these are both reported by F-Stoppers, is that Olympus shows a massive $157 million loss in its imaging division for the last fiscal year, partnered with another article titled Canon and Nikon report sales drop of over 17% since last year. So we are, I don't know if this is a temporary slump, but sales are definitely down in the industry at large. And it's your fault, Alan, because when you bought your last camera, your 5D Mark III, it was new to you, but it was not a new camera, right?
Right. I didn't need a new camera. This is actually,
that's the point that I'm trying to get to.
This is Canon's fault, though. I know it is my fault, but it's also Canon's fault for jamming a bunch of useless things in that I don't really need. Now, I wanted a Mark IV. I wanted the newest camera. I like the newest things. Don't tell my wife. No, I like those things, obviously. But when you start jamming unnecessary things in there and then ratcheting up the price, I say, okay, not only do I not want to pay for those, I don't want those to get in my way while I'm shooting.
Right.
That's it.
Which is actually why that I'm not against having paid firmware upgrades in cameras, because if you want to have a somewhat feature limited version of the product at a cheaper price point, and then you have to pay to play with those extra bells and whistles that the majority of people won't need, then by all means, roll that into an additional cost if you need those features. Don't throw those bells and whistles in, increasing the price like crazy, just to say that everybody has to have it and your profits will be better for it.
See, most of my cameras that I shoot Canon. I shoot in either AV mode, which is rare, or full manual. The end. No sports mode, no party mode, no action mode, no nighttime mode. None of the modes that are all added in. They just get in the way. They're part of the dial that I don't even need to see.
And who knows how many patents have to be licensed for those features to be there.
I'm not doing another callback to Dolby.
Okay. So we see the numbers from Olympus, and to read from the article here, the news came in that Olympus's financial results for the fiscal year ending March 31st of 2019, the company showed a $157 million loss in its imaging division, with a 19% year-over-year decrease in revenue, including a 23% decrease in mirrorless and an 18% decrease in compact cameras. I'm actually surprised that they're still doing the compact cameras.
Right.
It's not saying how much revenue it is. It's just a percentage decrease. And the report indicates a 14% gain in, quote, others. Now, Olympus, they've got a fairly strong medical imaging division as well. And I'm not sure if that would be what would be in the others category. I think that's an entirely separate entity. But one feeds the other. They develop the technology for the consumer space, and then it ends up in the medical space and back and forth. But those numbers, a 23% decrease in mirrorless market. I mean, they are huge in Micro Four Thirds. And they just released the OMD EM1X, which is their pro camera within their Micro Four Thirds lineup. And to see these numbers being so low for a mature platform, that's kind of scary. I mean, what do we care as end consumers? Well, we care that the next camera that we want to buy won't have enough of an R&D budget behind it in order to really make it worthwhile upgrading to, especially if the product cycles are lengthy enough as it is and the changes aren't as drastic as we would want them to be, right? I mean, there's a reason why you were happy enough to settle with the 5D Mark III, because it's not like the 5D Mark IV is going to get you gigs booked that they would say no to because you only have a 5D Mark III.
Right. I was shooting previously on the same gigs on a 5D Mark II, and they don't care. As long as it's good, as long as it looks good, they don't care. But so we saw this happen a couple of years ago with a television set. It's not called TV set anymore, is it? In the TV industry, the home televisions. Because remember when HD first came out, and oh my God, you get a 32-inch TV and it was like $4,000, et cetera, et cetera. And then the price, you know, went down and the size went up. And then everybody had one. And nobody was buying TVs anymore. And they said, okay, well, now what?
Well, now curved. Well, let's throw 3D, curved, 4K, 8K
now. Well, 3D was the first volley, and everybody kind of said, meh, that's not good. That's not good at all.
The implementation of 3D TVs, I think if you could have done it without glasses, it would have kind of transformed how we not only consume, but how many people produce content. I'm a stickler for 3D stuff. So, I mean, I'm off in a corner by myself chanting about it. But when 4K TVs were available, I mean, you see the tech demos in the store. They're brilliant. But what are you going to watch on 4K at home, right?
Yeah, I don't care for it. I mean, I know I'm a stickler for that. I like movies at 24 frames per second. I don't need stuff at 60. Stop it. It doesn't look good. But that's me. I understand that's me. Sports looks good. But they hit a wall. They said, okay, you Ultra HD, the curved screens, let's get people. Once they stop buying TVs, we're out of business. And that's what I see happening with the cameras now, because cameras are good. The cameras that normal people, that sounds terrible to say it like that. Okay, my mom. I meant my mom. The camera my mom uses is way better than things I was using in film school 20 years ago. So it's amazing. What is missing? What can Olympus put in, besides the X-ray joke from earlier, what is Olympus or everybody? What's missing from cameras right now?
Well, I mean, the test bed of technology that Olympus has with the EM1X is pretty full featured. I mean, their image stabilizer and their handheld multi-shot high resolution mode, that could be of an advantage to some people with a camera of that size. I've been using the new Panasonic Lumix S1R recently at 47 megapixels, and I'm happy with the results, because I can get further away from a subject. An image that I might be posting later today is of the flowers of a maple tree. I didn't even know maple trees had flowers, because they're green and you don't notice them until a friend of mine who got into the ultraviolet stuff the same as I did showed a picture. I'm like, okay, got to wait for those trees to bloom. But I didn't have to focus stack the image. I could have added more depth. But I could just get further away and crop down to 20 megapixels. I don't need the 47, but I can get the 20 in a way that is very conducive to that image. Or shoot 187 megapixel images with its pixel shift technology and get even further away. There's a client that gets me to shoot high resolution computer components that they manufacture for their catalogs and whatever else. And I would have to focus stack that quite intensely across many, many frames, but they only need like a 10 megapixel deliverable. So what if I could take an almost 200 megapixel image, crop it down to 10 megapixels without focus stacking? Bob's your uncle. Instead of doing a day's work for all of these images, I can do an hour's work. Then yeah, that could be a useful bit of technology. But all of these extra features I do find are niches, or you have to really stress to find a use case that will actually pay for the additional features that we're receiving today. There's nothing truly revolutionary at this point, because right. The revolutionary ideas are in your head, not in your camera.
That is true. And that, all joking aside, that's what started the invisible camera many years ago. It was that exact thing. It was the idea that I wanted that revolution. And it was all in my head, 100%. But I love those revolutionary ideas. And I kind of miss, not even them being mine, I like seeing other people have them.
Remember when digital photography first started to gain in popularity, and the manufacturers realized that they didn't have to make cameras that looked like traditional cameras anymore, because you didn't have to, you know, feed a film canister across a film plane and re-spool it on the other side. And you had all these really wonky cameras that could like rotate 50 degrees, like at their midpoint and
the
do
Mavic
strange
or whatever
stuff.
It was called. It was, yeah.
Well, the Mavic, the Sony Mavica used floppy disks as recording medium.
And then CDs, that's right.
Yeah, and but I mean, that was a revolutionary time in terms of cameras that we mostly just kind of shun and forget ever happened, like the vehicle designs of the 1980s.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, although we used to have a 1978 Ford Granada, and that was a ugly thing to look at. So you're right.
Even you know, cars that have pedigrees made in the 1980s, like Mustangs, you know, just forget about them. They take them out of the museum.
Yeah.
They don't belong. But so yeah, photography is an interesting space. Now, Canon and Nikon have reports of around Canon is 17, Nikon is 17.9. They're all kind of in the same ballpark. Now, Canon says the contraction of the market, and I'm reading from the F-Stoppers article here, contraction of the market for interchangeable lens cameras, mainly DSLRs, continue to in step with the proliferation of smartphones, resulting in a significant decline in sales and profits. In the first quarter, sales of interchangeable lens cameras were down 19% to 850,000 units. This reflects the combined impact of accelerated market contraction, in particular, the entry-level models. And we talked about that on a previous episode, how they're kind of really cutting corners on those entry-level cameras. Mm-hmm. The economic slowdown in China, which is a sizable market for these interchangeable lens cameras. Nikon continues to say that for the digital camera interchangeable lens type, sales of the D850, a digital SLR camera, in case people didn't know, I'm just reading from the article, were strong, and the group made efforts to increase the sales of the new Z7 and Z6 full-frame mirrorless cameras, which have earned favorable reviews. That, if you're reading between the lines there, they're saying that the D850 is outselling the Z6 and Z7. Right. They're saying that the reviews are favorable and they're making efforts to increase the sales of them. It means it's not doing as well as they would have liked. And that's my interpretation of that.
Sounds about right, yeah.
And they continue to say, however, the sales units of both the digital interchangeable lens type and compact cameras fell amidst the shrinking market. Everybody's complaining about a shrinking market. And as we've said, there's no real revolutionary thing here, but I think Canon and Nikon, they're in a slightly different boat than Olympus, because they're in the process of jumping into an immature platform. Canon with the EOS R, Nikon with their Z series, and I'm sure you could put Fuji in that same boat with their medium format, Panasonic with their new full frame stuff, and even Sigma to a lesser degree, because they'll be jumping into the L mount, making cameras there too. People don't like to buy into a new platform as easily as they would buy into something that has significant pedigree, even if you have full backwards compatibility with your existing glass and at least some of your existing accessories. So once these platforms mature and they've got a stronger lens lineup, that might even in some ways be revolutionary. Like the new Canon RF 85mm f1.2 lens that has different optical coatings on it that will give a soft focus effect rather than having a different optical design, at a sacrifice of about a stop and a half, if I remember correctly. When you're shooting wide open with this lens, the bokeh properties are just butter smooth rather than having some geometric shapes or harder edges. And that's useful for some people shooting in wide open in portrait scenarios that don't care about the loss of light. And so there are changes coming, but that's not out yet. And when it does come out, then I think people will say, okay, well, now the proof is in the pudding. A year or two in, this platform is more mature and the sales will shift accordingly. At least that's my theory, my prediction.
It worked out for Apple, because I remember I wasn't what you would call an early adopter, but I was relatively early. I was the first person I knew to actually own an Apple. I bought my G4 Tower in 1998, 99, and so they were making inroads, but they hadn't blown up yet. And so the deal was, I remember going into the store to buy it, and I didn't know enough about it, et cetera, and basically was like, okay, like, am I going to be able to run my Windows programs on this? And oh yeah, there's a Windows emulator and there's this and
yeah,
this.
Yeah, the PowerPC days were a bit sketchy for all
and
of that.
Yeah, of course. But my whole thing was but having it being back, the ability to be backwards compatible, I didn't want to take my foot off first base, but I still wanted to steal a second. And so I understand that mindset. And then once I got into it and was using Apple, I realized, Oh, I never ever need to use my Windows stuff. Forget it. Almost never. And so,
right. But you were hung up on that at the point of purchase, right? And that's really the critical point here.
Yeah, and I was sold, but you know, I was the guy to, oh yeah, of course, like he's selling me a computer. Like this is before the even the Apple store. And so he was just like, "Oh yeah, yeah, sure. Of course. Yeah, whatever you want to hear, kid. You're buying this computer. Like you're getting out." Now, I'm glad I did because it's tough to be an Apple snob when you don't have an Apple. So that was kind of key, but I do understand the nature of backwards compatibility. I mean, I like the idea of mirrorless. It's just that I have a bunch of lenses that I don't want to sell.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I'm in the process right now of selling some of my Canon gear. I just sold my 24 millimeter f1.4 prime lens, which I loved, but you know, it's a lens that I rarely ever used, even when I was using the Canon platform. And you know, frustrating story. If anybody wants to buy a Canon 1DX Mark II, it's still available because I sold it on eBay. You know, plugged in the address and everything, and shipped it via FedEx, fully insured, which cost me like $200 to ship this to the US. I should have had a red flag immediately come up because the phone number provided by the purchaser had a +7 country code, which is Russia. Uh-huh. And so the address where I was sending it to was an intermediary that would then just receive shipments and then send them off to wherever the actual recipient was. But for customs purposes, especially of something of that value, the recipient had to be in the U.S. and had to have a valid social security number and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I contacted the buyer and he said, well, no, he doesn't have that. But he could provide his sister's information. And then he asked me to ship it in two separate packages with lower values. And I'm like, you know, my seller protections are probably going out the window at this point. Right. When I'm changing the actual contact information and shipping it in multiple packages, knowing full well that it's not going to stay in the US.
Why don't I just take it out in the front yard and smash it with a hammer? That would actually be more acceptable than what you're suggesting.
Yeah, and so I ended up giving the guy a complete refund on that purchase. And then he gave me a scathing negative review on eBay as a result of this.
Because
I wouldn't ship my camera to Russia.
Yeah, all right. Well, you'll be fine.
So if anybody's looking at my eBay listings right now and you're concerned about that most recent negative review, well, then it's that Russian jerk. Anyhow, I'll get off my soapbox. So what were we talking about? Oh, right. Cameras, lenses, and compatibility. You know, I have the adapters that I can use all the stuff that I have. And especially when I'm getting my older mechanical lenses that have a really nice character to them or a tactile feeling, those are infinitely adaptable to any platform.
Now with the different flange distance, et cetera, because I tried to do that. I really wanted to adapt my old EF lenses to not the EF lenses. Yeah, EF lenses.
The FD lenses.
FD lenses 87 to my EF.
Earlier, yeah.
Yeah, I had a bunch of those that are really great lenses. I love using. I wanted to use them specifically for video because of the manual focus. And they said, yeah, of course you can get these adapters. And then you get them, and well, now the flange just now your 28 mil lens is effectively a 130 mil lens, and so all of a sudden it doesn't work out so well. So everything's kind of macro.
The issue with that would be if you don't use an optical adapter to put an FD lens on an EF body, then you would lose infinity focus. And it's not just like you lose infinity, you lose everything between, you know, infinity and 5 feet away from the camera in most cases.
Right. Now, I did buy one and effectively had a macro lens at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I really didn't need one, so I sent it back. And I wish I kept it for about $30 or something like that. I wish I kept it just for macro ability, but it wasn't tremendously useful to me. And so I was kind of scared off of adapters, even to the point where I was considering shifting to mirrorless and going with the Sony, et cetera. And I thought, well, people are saying, yeah, you get the what do you call it, Bones adapter. And
Metabones, yeah.
The Metabones, and everyone loves it, and it's just as fast. And I thought, well, I had that one experience, and so I was kind of done.
I've got some Metabones adapters, both with glass and without. Mm-hmm. I find that the ones with glass, they work well on general purpose lenses, the speed boosters, to take a full frame image down and shrink that image circle down to a micro four thirds sensor size. It did not work well on my high magnification macro lenses. They just mm-hmm. didn't behave properly, but other lenses did. So, I mean, your mileage may vary. However, if you're going to any mirrorless platform, that flange distance is much shorter than the EF mount would have been. And so your compatibility with those manual FD lenses or anything that might use the X-Acta mount or a Leica M mount or any of the screw mounts out there, that would be completely universal. You just got to make sure that you get the right piece of machined aluminum to couple things together.
Yep. I tend to prefer things that are dedicated. I mean, rather than adapted, ask the guys on Apollo 13 what they thought, you know.
Yeah.
They would have gone, but it worked out for them.
Well, and one brief aside too, I was mentioning at the top of the show, one of my students was here, booked me for a workshop, received a Meyer Optic Gorlitz Trioplan 100 from B&H, which the reason why I'm mentioning this, we're talking about manual sort of tactile lenses. That lens is known for its soap bubble bokeh. But Meyer Optic, or the parent company for them, NetSE, went belly up, and they went bankrupt. But most of the Meyer Optic brand and potentially their assets were purchased by one of their creditors, or were given in terms of the bankruptcy proceedings. And so B&H didn't have them in stock. And then now they had them in stock and shipped one out to him at a price much less than I paid. And I'm a little bit envious. So if anybody was looking for those Trioplan 100s for its optical marvels, the optical formula on that thing dates back to 1916. It's not exactly new, but you can get the newest version of that apparently still available. So OPC is the parent company that now owns the Meyer Optic brand, and they may have new old stock from their acquisition, and they could be shipping that out. So just keep an eye out for that if anybody wants to see those lenses resurrected. Okay, let's move on to our final story. This one kind of gave me a chuckle. Alan, did you watch the video for this?
I didn't have a chance to see the video, no.
Okay, so it's a five-minute video. Shame on you for not giving it 5 minutes, although I did drop this on you at the very last minute to be the guest host, so that's on me. But the title of the article from Petapixel is Why Photographers Aren't Getting Paid. And it's a five-minute video from Jessica Kobayashi, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly. She's got quite the following on YouTube, 1.3 million followers or thereabouts. And she basically got a question or a remark from one of her listeners or watchers that said a local business wanted me to shoot their fashion show for free. So I just didn't show up. And the next day, their Facebook page invited me to like the other photographer's page who did it for free. Okay, uh-huh. So I mean, I'm not one to work for free, aside from like charity stuff that I personally support and I'm not cold called to support. But when people ask to use my work for free, when they ask me to shoot for free, and sometimes it's been, you know, can we use this footage for a nonprofit organization? Well, yeah, you're a nonprofit, but so many nonprofits have CEOs that make like $800,000.
Yes.
Just because you're a nonprofit doesn't mean that you can't afford me. And so this bothers me to no end, but I'll often get asked for my work to be used for free. And I say no. And I'll often come up with a price. And then I don't hear back anything. They've gone off. They've asked another photographer.
But the exposure you missed out on, Don.
Yes, the exposure, I don't want to toot my own horn. I am a successful photographer in the sense that my living is photography, and I'm in a house right now where the mortgage is paid by my work, right? Exposure doesn't pay my mortgage.
No.
It's not something that I can take to the bank. So the issue here is if we all don't say no, then people will just keep going and going and going until they find somebody that says yes, and then those photographers will be working for free. But if they just said no, they wouldn't be working for free. They'd be getting paid. So if we all just said no to free jobs,
yeah,
we would all get even just some amount of money. It doesn't have to be a whole lot, but just charge people something.
Okay, I can't believe we're still having this discussion in 2019, right? it's absurd. This has been going on for a long time. It's really kind of with the introduction of the DSLR. That's when kind of wedding the first people landing on the beach, I think, were the wedding photographers. That's where they were really eating it. Before the newspapers, et cetera, et cetera. But weddings were the big thing because, you know, my Uncle Mike, he's got a pretty decent – he's got a 10D. So he's going to do it.
He can shoot the wedding, and then he has a couple of too many wobbly pops. And sure. And your wedding photos are not nearly what you expected them to be.
No, they aren't. But – I mean, I got married 10 years ago. We did a hybrid of this. Like we hired someone to come out that we sort of knew, or my in-laws knew. And I said, okay, yeah, I'm going to, you know, give her not very much money. I mean, it was a decent hourly rate, but it'd come out for a couple of hours, shoot the ceremony, a couple of photos after, and that's that. And the rest of it, I don't care if I get snapshots from Uncle Wobbly Pop. That's cool. I got the main things done. I paid for it. I wasn't trying to get anything for free. But the rest of it, I said, you know what? I don't need a $5,000 wedding photographer. That's not for me. Not saying it's not worth the money. It is. They are worth the money. If someone's charging that, they're probably pretty good. Go ahead and get them. But for me, it wasn't that important. So I have been asked to work for free before, and I had a job that was, it was really quite funny. It was told, I was brand new out of film school. I got an opportunity to go and work and shoot the behind the scenes, like a making of a movie being filmed in Vancouver.
Cool.
Now it was a super low budget movie. So like I think the budget would have been like $1 million, whatever it was 15 years ago, which was still not very much money. But I said, you know what? I'm going to break in here. I'm going to make friends with the actors and friends with the director, the producers. Like, this is a huge in for me. So I'm going to come in. I'm going to shoot this. It's a 19-day shoot. I'm going to shoot all the really professional looking behind the scenes. It's going to go on the DVD. And it worked out. It's great. The producer called me back because he didn't even like it. The producer didn't want me around. He didn't. This is the beginning. He didn't understand what I was doing there. And he saw the final product, and he thought, this is fantastic. Hey, I'm producing another movie with so-and-so in it. I'd like you to come out. That's going to be the same deal. I said, whoa, wait, are you kidding me? Why would I just made you a bunch of money. Why would it be the same deal? And he balked and said, oh, we're not paying anybody for this. I said, okay, well, that's absurd.
I mean, even like just slip you a Mackenzie King or something. If you're not familiar with Canadian currency, that's a $50 bill. But
I wanted more than that. But
I understand that I would never ask for that little either. My point was something. I mean, just anything, even just an offer of something, and then you counter with the offer that you actually want. But if their initial ask is free, that's an even greater insult.
It is. And just to assume that I would do it. And this guy was a very successful producer, and what he was doing, not a name you would know, a name you'll know after the show because I'll tell you, but what a jackass. Is that, can we say that on your show? Is that
sure,
explicit?
Why not?
Okay. Just a jerk. And I was glad to, I never spoke to that guy again. And I was fine. I spoke to a lot of the director I spoke to again, the other actors, actors that you know, great guys. This guy, just a jerk. So don't do it. But here's the other thing. Here's the other thing I like to tell people who are kind of on your side about this. Don't swim against the riptide, man. It just pulls you out in the ocean. Now, you can't stop. People are not going to stop working for free for so-called exposure.
Then you have to try to add value to whatever you're producing above and beyond what people were expecting. So maybe you come back to them and say, hey, you know what? I've got this idea. We can work on what you want, but I'm going to do this, and this is how much it's going to cost. We've got to bundle this together.
Yeah. Right?
You got to find some way to, I don't want to say upsell because that's kind of a dirty word. You know, it's, you're not trying to be a salesman per se. You want to make sure that you're doing the best possible job, and you've got ideas to make that happen. Just the other day, I got an email from somebody asking me, and this is the global village that we are in right now. They found me through some means, and the dialogue is continuing, but they grow and sell beneficial insects. We're talking,
ladybugs.
Stuff that might, ladybugs that might eat things, or maybe, pollinating bees or whatever. We're still in the discussion phase here, but they contacted me and they're going to be willing to pay, of course. But I have a specialty in the photography world of macro photography, and I've done a lot of good insect photography as well. And so that work and those skills are being appreciated by somebody in a very niche market mm-hmm. that requires the skills of a professional photographer to create images for them for which they are willing to pay. You are a photographer, therefore you have skills that other people do not have, to varying degrees, of course.
Well,
but so you should be charging to varying degrees for your work. And if people pull the exposure card, I mean, sometimes I don't even respond. Sometimes I just
move over that. No, that's a red flag right there. If somebody offers exposure, the word exposure, I mean, there are variants of it that I would say, I wouldn't say, hey, go out of your way to work for free, but if you can pick your, there's a couple times where you can pick your spots, you can work for a largely discounted price, it will be beneficial to you. But you really, I've been burned a couple times, and I've had a couple instances where it's worked out fantastically. But you have to recognize the niche you're in, that particular job, if there's 500 people in a 3-mile radius who can do it, you're not that valuable.
Okay. So, and I agree. But the same day that I got that email about the insect photography guy, I also got this other email. There's the contact form on my website. So the subject is photographer in Ontario. The body is, hello, I need a photographer to cover my wife's 50th birthday on the 13th of June, 2019. I would need a high quality edited images. I'm reading his mistakes as he says mm-hmm. them. Would you be available at the specified date to cover my wife's birthday? In Ontario, if so, reply me ASAP. Okay, now this is a derivation of the family reunion scam, I'm certain of it, because you don't ask for a photographer in Ontario. In Ontario,
right.
You know, from Thunder Bay to Ottawa, the distance between Thunder Bay and Ottawa is greater than the distance between Paris, France, and Zagreb, Croatia.
Right.
Okay, you don't just say you need a photographer in Ontario with broken English and, mm-hmm. you know, at the specified date, the language is just suspicious at the very least. So anyhow, I respond to this guy basically saying, stop scamming people and reevaluate your life.
Which he took to heart, and he's probably stopped now.
I don't think so.
No, no. Definitely a red flag. But what you did, Don, is you didn't get sucked in the riptide. You swam parallel to shore until you found your way in, and you maximized that. And that's what I just suggest people to do. You're never going to get photographers to all charge the proper amount for their work, and therefore you're competing with a bunch of people who do not value themselves. Too bad. That ship has sailed. In essence, except for a few niches, sadly, the photography business is probably dead as we knew it.
As we knew it, but not as it will become, because it is a transforming organism.
Sure.
It is going through that metamorphosis. It is a chrysalis, as it were, and who knows what's going to come out on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're riding the wave. We got to be there. I mean, it's the industry that we are in to some degree. Of course, the work that I do is licensing work that I've already created, teaching photographers, their speaking engagements. There is commissioned work, so many different things, including a book on macro photography that I'll be announcing in the next couple of weeks for crowdfunding that I'm hoping to have everybody's support on. Photographers have to wear more hats today than I think we've ever had to in the past.
My suggestion to people who would like to get paid for their work, though, is choose your clients carefully. And look for people. I'm a firm believer in indicators in life and in behavior specifically. And if you find a client who is very successful and has self-esteem, you will find a paying client.
That is sage advice. Thank you for that, Alan. That about puts the pin in the stories for the week. If we could get into then our picks of the week, as we like to end off every show with. Mine is, it's something that I think that we could all just find a bit of curiosity with, and it's not expensive. It's going to be under $8 US, available on Amazon. I've got a fairly fancy one that's a little bit different. It's called a star analyzer, but it's the same technology. It is a diffraction grating. And a diffraction grating allows you to split a light source into its component wavelengths. You get to see basically a rainbow of violet through red of the light that is being emitted by your light source. Why is this important? Well, if you're using an incandescent or a halogen bulb, most of the times they have a fairly even frequency. They represent most of the colors that we can see with our own eyes equally. This is not true of every light source. Why is this important? Well, our eyes will see a light source as the average of everything that it produces. So if we look at a fluorescent light bulb, for example, we will see it as white, or like maybe it might be balanced to be daylight or whatever, but we see it as roughly white. If you were to hold up a diffraction grating, also called a spectroscope or a spectrometer, to that light source, you would see, instead of a complete rainbow, you would see banding. You would only see the light that is emitted based on where in the spectrum it is. And so for $7.77, I think the one that I found, you can get a little pocket. It's a cheap piece of plastic thing. It's not going to be anything fancy. It's purely optical. There's no electronics or anything within this. But you take that and go point that at the light sources in your own home, especially if you know you still have compact fluorescent or fluorescent lighting, and see just how good that light is in terms of quality. Now, at home or in studio, you might be taking pictures under that light. And if the quality of the light being emitted from that, like the worst compact fluorescents only emit half the spectrum of light. And so when you try to get color rendition proper, it's almost impossible in post-processing because not all of the colors were emitted from the light source to bounce off of your subject accordingly.
But I have 64 megapixels.
Well, yeah, that'll cover it. But if you have prints on your wall too, you want to make sure that those prints are being displayed in the best light possible. And for less than $10, you can get a little device that will, at the very least, it's fun for kids to go around and point at the lights too as a learning experiment. So just something fun, an EISCO premium quantitative spectroscope with plus and minus 5 nanometer accuracy, even though we don't really care about all that, is right. $7.77 on Amazon. Hey, you've got an Amazon affiliate code. I should get that and put the link up with that for you.
That'd be great. I don't know what that is. I'll have to Google that myself.
All right.
Find out where that is.
What is your pick?
I went back for the old camera, the old, when you were saying that, you know, people don't want to necessarily invest in a new technology. Well, mirrorless is kind of an old technology. And, well, here's the old version of it. I happen to own a Canonet QL19, a film camera, a rangefinder film camera. And I love
this thing. It's
positively
sparkling. It's that looks like you've kept it in great shape.
I bought it about 6-7 years ago, so I bought it used. I wish it was new. I did want one of the QL17s, but they're very hard to find for under $200 now for some reason. These have become a little too popular, actually, so maybe I shouldn't recommend it.
Already have yours. That's
why. So much so that I actually, every time I would see one pop up on Craigslist when I was in Vancouver or had a friend there, I would basically buy it. Pretty much sight unseen, because it'd be under $20. I'd take a gamble, got one that didn't work out so well. Kind of had to toss it, but it was $20 gamble. I didn't mind that much. But this one's in great shape for the most part. Still works great. The meter not so much, but you don't need that. You have the Sony 16. You can figure that out. And what I was talking about earlier about my 5D Mark III and all my Canon cameras having too much tech getting in the way, this is the exact opposite. There is almost nothing to this. You set the aperture, the shutter speed right on the barrel, and off you go. And yes, you have to shoot film and get it processed, but this camera is a lot of fun and you'll love the photos.
And, you know, film processing, as we talked about in one of our recent episodes when Steve Brokaw was on, you know, it's not difficult to do that yourself,
right,
whether it's color or black and white. Actually, color is more consistent in terms of the, you know, the, it's always C41 and the timings are always the same. And black and white, of course, can be a little bit more creative, but that's just part of the experience that you can have. Film is getting more expensive. I think Fuji just announced that most of their film stocks are going up in price across the board.
Right.
But so long as it's still available by somebody at any price, that camera will be useful for you.
I do process my own black and white in the basement when I get a chance. Obviously with kids, I have a couple kids. And so, you know, your time isn't as plentiful as it once was, but I really enjoy it. I love shooting these. I mean, we've had this is the old discussion of film versus digital, etc. I'm not having that. This is fun. Get one. And they're probably, you can probably find them for around $20, maybe a little bit more now as they got more popular.
And I've been finding just putting the old lenses on a modern camera kind of give me a similar experience. Yes, it's not film, and technology is a part of that process, but there's a certain level of convenience while I still get a an interesting look to the resulting images. So whatever balance you want to strike for yourself, so long as you can find your work fun and entertaining and keep yourself impassioned, then get those tools. And that's a great recommendation, Alan. So,
well, forget the film part of it. If make a Canon. You want that 17% back? Make a digital Canonette. Okay? That's it. You'll get it back. I will buy one.
Perfect. There we go.
Down.
At the very least, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. I'll put like an eBay search link so that people can see what's out there available on the market and maybe pick one up for themselves. And maybe you'll find a related camera that appears to your interest. There's tons of those old vintage cameras that just feel great in your hands. And just having that tactile response, I think, brings me back to the reason why I loved photography to begin with, even though I started in the digital era. All right. With that said, Alan, where can people find you and your podcast?
You can check us out at twohosers.com, where you can find our podcast, or my stuff at alanatridge.com, which I update never, which means it's a good thing. It means you're busy.
Exactly. It means if you're too busy to update your website, then that's great. Then you don't need to.
Right.
And I haven't updated mine in forever. And somebody pointed it out the other day that it is terribly not mobile friendly. I need to go and redesign that.
So it is worth going to my site to see my about page to see how dark my hair was.
Oh, the younger you. It's time to get a new portrait done. Maybe a selfie.
Yeah, we'll see.
Do you do many selfies?
Not really.
No.
No.
No. All right. But that being said, at the very least, we should all get out and shoot.